would be interested in knowing how long, to begin with, you've been part of the Three Stooges and how they began.
Well, first of all, I'd like to request that you call me Mo in preference to Mr. Howard. Fortunately, I know that people know me as Mr. Howard only in my social life. Out into left field, it's just Mo in every direction. The Three Stooges was a development, you see. It wasn't planned as an organization. I started with a fellow called Ted Healy in 1922. He was a boyhood friend of mine, and he traveled off into one end of show business while I was in another. And we got together and worked along for about a year. Then my older brother, Shemp, joined with us, made it Two Stooges. And it happened in a very funny way. I used to come from the audience and work with Healy. I'd give him a note of reference and a recommendation and just praised myself to the sky, told him I sang like Gella Kirchy, and he says, "Why, Gella Kirchy's a woman," and I would say, "Oh, I know that, you know." And finally, I heard my brother Shemp laugh in the audience. So I whispered to Ted, I said, "Ted Shemp's out there." So he stepped to the footlights and says, "I'd like to have another young man come up here, preferably from Brooklyn." And sure enough, Shemp came up. Then we had a little tangle tour there. He came up eating a pear and asked Ted if he wanted it. Ted said no, so he pushed it in his face, and there was a whole wrestle going on. That then became Two. That was in 1922. And we traveled along that way until late in 22. Ted took his brother-in-law in as a third man because his wife had asked him to give him a job of some kind. He was very inexperienced. And so inexperienced that it became funny only to us, see. So that traveled along for about 4 months, and Ted couldn't stand that any longer. So it was Shemp and I until early 1925 when we picked up Larry.
Now, at this point, were you actually being billed as the Two Stooges?
Oh, no. No. It was Ted Healy and the boys at that time. And Larry was working in a nightclub in Chicago. He had left his wife and sister-in-law, who were doing a singing and dancing flash act, they used to call those in vaudeville. And he had some kind of a beef with his wife and sister-in-law, and they broke it up. He wasn't getting the proper billing, you see. Once they call it the Haney Sisters and Fine, and then they call it the Haney Sisters and Company. He didn't like that, you see. So we saw him entertaining there, and I turned to Ted. We watched him that night. He was doing a Russian dance in tails and a hi-hat and playing a fiddle at the same time. So we could see through that pretty much. So when he went to his dressing room, we went back there and asked him if he would care to join up with the Stooges. I said, "Yeah, I'd love it." So Healy says, "I'll give you $90 a week and $10 extra if you put that file in the way." So that became Three in 1925. Then we were called Ted Healy and his gang, Ted Healy and his Three Southern Gentlemen, Ted Healy and his Racketeers. At one time, he must have had about 12 Stooges on the stage at one time. It was like a three-ring circus. And that was the getting together of the three original, my brother Champagne and Larry. Then in 1932, my brother Shemp got the opportunity to play the character Nobby in the Joe Palooka picture. And we said, "You go ahead. Don't worry anything about it. We'll get the young brother, whom we called Babe. His name was Jerome. And they called him Curly." So that's when Curly came into the picture in 1932. So it was Mo, Larry, and Curly from 1932 to 1946, when Curly became very ill. And Shemp rejoined us from 1946 Curly passed away in 52, and then Shemp passed away in 55.
What had Shemp been doing in the meantime?
Oh, he was under contract to Universal. He was at MGM. Did some great parts. Several times he did parts that were completely silent, only in pantomime. Great. And, but he was anxious to get back into the set with us, you know. It was more carefree. It was a hard study, you know. He got into the habit of, when we got into a scene and one of us would talk, he would lip the same dialogue, you know. His mouth would keep moving his lips. And when you see it in the dailies, you know, in the rushes, we'd look and the director was saying, huh? What's him saying? He studied so hard that he knew everybody's part. And he talked it along with him, you know. So we cut him out of that habit. It took quite some time. So Shemp passed away in 55. Of course, Curly lingered for 6 years, and Shemp went out of the picture in about 30 seconds.
What? How did you get into movies? When did that begin?
For me, it began in 1908. When I was a young boy.
Where are you from? I didn't even ask you that.
Brooklyn, New York.
Is Mo Howard your real name?
Yes. Middle name Harry, but I never use it. I did use it years ago and left out the Mo. I didn't use Mo until I joined with Healy. So, yes, I was in many, many films from 1908 to 1911. I must have been in 40 or 50 films.
Where were they made at that time?
At the Vitagraph Company in Brooklyn. Off on the Brighton Line, Avenue M and Neck Road. The old Vitagraph studio. Which later, Warner Brothers bought. And now has become a Jewish seminary for girls. And it was very nostalgic when we did the... we did a show for ABC, I think it was. Who's Afraid of Mother Goose? And we shot it on NBC equipment across from the Vitagraph studio. And then when I stood in that corner, I remembered. Now, this was about 5 years ago, and I remembered back in 1908 when I only attended 13 days out of a semester at school, and the truant officer was looking for me all the time. Never found me, though. And, I horned my way into the studio by asking if they wanted me to go for sandwiches for them around lunch hour, you know. And after about 3 or 4 weeks of doing that, the director called me over. It was a boy star called Kenneth Casey. The director was Van Dyke Brooks. He called me and said, would you help us out and do a little bit in the Kenneth Casey picture? I said, sure. Fine. We were working in an orphanage in Brooklyn, that picture was. And I did a day's work, and I got a half a dollar, which in those days, well, I mean, compared to today, that half dollar would probably be $4. Then some pictures I got a dollar for, some I got $5. I worked with Maurice Costello, names which you probably haven't heard. I mean...
The father of Dolores Costello, very big stage name.
Oh, yes, he was a matinee idol. And, of course, there was John Bunny and Flora Finch.
I've always wanted to talk with someone who worked with John Bunny. I've never seen him except his pictures, but he looks like the funniest man in the world.
Yeah, he was a pleasant man. He laughed a lot. In fact, he spoiled a lot of film by laughing in the wrong places.
Someone told me he really didn't drink. He always looked like he had a snoot.
He looked like a rum nose. Yeah. He had a nose to match, but he never drank. I ran sandwiches for him. He used to eat sardine sandwiches and a glass of root beer, a carton of root beer. That was his drinking. And Flora Finch, he was short and fat, and she was like a string bean. Wonderful woman, though. And there was Florence Turner, in those days, the equal of, what's the one that Howard Hughes made wings with?
Jean Harlow.
Jean Harlow. She was the Jean Harlow of that day with her deep dimples and There was Lillian Walker. Florence.
She's still around, Lillian Walker.
Not
she lives
one.
In the, Lillian, she worked for Crest Pictures, was the, she lives down in the Caribbean. She's very old.
Oh, she would have to
she
be was,
she
old.
Co-starred with Wally Vann, is that the same one?
That's the one.
Well, Wally yeah. Vann's still around, I see him.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, that's the one.
She's still with us.
Yeah, that's good. And there was a bunch of other stars that used to work for Vitagraph there. And I did a little work for Biograph up in the Bronx. After I got accustomed, then I went with a couple of independent studios in Red Bank, New Jersey. They had some studios there. Of course, Selig had their studio in Chicago. And Bronco Billy Anderson and the Kalem Company came out of Chicago and came to the coast.
Well, he's still alive, too.
Bronco Billy?
Yeah, he was at the Motion Picture Country Home until a couple of weeks ago, and I called out there, and they said, no, he felt too well, he left.
So that's wonderful. And, of course, Francis X. Bushman, he died recently. So, I mean, we don't want to bring up the dead ones. We talk about the live ones.
What about the shorts that you began making? Was that in the 30s that you started?
Yes, we started originally at MGM. We made five two-reel comedies in 1933. And while they were talking about an option, Columbia signed us to a 24-year straight deal. No options. We started there in the early summer of 1934 and finished on January 12, 1958 and made 204 two-reelers, besides features and things like that.
Did you make them over here on the Gower Street lot?
Yes, we made in the early days. They didn't have the ranch in the early days, you see. And they only had, they had stage one, with, had that tank of water in front on Gower. Then they had, then they acquired stage two and three, which they leased from that old independent producer, Chadwick. An old man, Chadwick. That, and then they got a hold of Stage 7, where we did most of our work on.
Weren't the Poverty Row studios around that neighborhood, didn't they take up some of the
yes,
property?
Yes, that's what Columbia bought up.
That's what they were called,
blocks.
Right? Poverty Row?
Yeah, Poverty Row, and Gower Gulch, and the whole thing. Oh, sure, where the Bank of America is. You know, on Sunset and Gower? Well, there was a barn there that was a studio. An Ince.
Thomas Ince.
Thomas Ince's studio was there. Right on that corner.
What was it like when you came?
30, I came in 30. We made a picture at Fox called Soup to Nuts. It was written by Rube Goldberg, who recently died, a cartoonist. All the action was around Western Avenue. There was nothing up the other way at all.
Well, now, the Fox lot was up by Western. What else was there?
Well, Paramount, up on Melrose, in that area. RKO on Gower Street and Melrose. They were the big ones. RKO, Paramount, and Columbia had those. Well, they started in, 1926 with the Hallroom Boys. Remember that?
I do.
Well, there used to be a comic strip in the newspapers called The Hallroom Boys. And there were two Irish lads that Harry Cohn got a hold of and made a cheap series. You know, in the early days, the smaller studios, I must put it this way, the film business, which meant the camera and the processing and the film, was controlled by about three companies. The big companies, and they wouldn't permit any other companies to make features. Universal couldn't make features. Columbia, RKO, Paramount, none of them could make features. They were allowed one-reelers. And if they went beyond that, they couldn't get film or they couldn't get the use of a camera. So they stuck to that, and after a while, they went to two-reelers. But Universal broke that up. Old man...
Lemley. Carl Lemley, Sr.
Yes, Sr. He broke up that combination. Took a little time, but he busted it up.
tell me, what were your impressions of Harry Cohn? Everybody wants to know about him.
Well, Harry Cohn, behind his desk, was a tyrant. And rightfully so. Because pulling at his coattails to get him away from that desk was his brother, who was in New York, and his brother's henchman, who controlled the sales end in the New York section, while Harry took care of the production end here in the studio. And he had the Briskins in there with him, who were also trying to. Sam Briskin was kind of in the high echelon with Harry Cohn in there. And he, too, would, I believe, this is my contention, that he, too, was trying to pull Harry Cohn off his seat. So he fought like a demon. But away from that desk, and I knew him well, in fact, my name is in the book, he was as fine a guy as I ever met in my life. He'd go out of his way to do things for people. But as I say, he, although to us, every time he saw us, like just come heading for the studio, when his car pulled up with the chauffeur and he came out, he put his arm around and says, come on up in the office. We go up there, we sit on the couch in his office. He pick up the telephone and he calls somebody at MGM and call him the vilest names. Some big shot there and call him, and then he'd hang up after he's still. He'd look at us and say, what do you fellas want? You know, he called us up there for we could listen to him bawl out somebody, you know. So this is the kind of a character he was.
He never gave you any trouble at all, though,
never,
personally?
Not one minute. In fact, when my kid brother Curly, in one of the scenes where some gangsters mistook us for doctors, of course we had white coats on, actually, we were cleaning up the office when they came in with one of their men wounded and wanted us to take the bullet out of him. We tried to tell them that we weren't doctors, but they wouldn't listen. So we put him on the table, this gunman, and as Curly went across to get a cover to put on him, he stepped on a pedal which tilted the table, and the gunman flew out the window right through the roof of the cop's car downstairs, see? Now, when these fellas are knocking on the door, they want to come in and see how he's doing. He wasn't there. So we had to put Curly under the sheet. And then that pedal went again, only Curly was so heavy that when the table tilted, it tilted too far, and his head hit the edge of the windowsill. And later, he got 9 stitches in his head. But we didn't want to stop production, so they clipped the hair away from the cut, put some collodion on it, and sprayed more hair on top. But after it was heard, 5 minutes after that happened, Harry Cohn was on the set to see how everything was. He showed great concern, which he never did for anyone else. I mean, there were people around, you know, like Victor Schertzinger with those wonderful pictures of One Night of Love, and, you know, and, there was
the Frank great Capra.
Yeah, John Barrymore and Carol Lombard in 20th Century. Frank Capra with
Happened One Night, Lost Horizon.
Yes, yeah, well, It Happened One Night was the one when we were there in the early setup. He made many there. So I say that Harry Cohn showed great concern when something happened to any one of us, even when my eyes got loaded with a bunch of powdered asbestos and ketchup. And it took the doctor's department there, that little hospital we had in the studio, it took him about 4.5 hours to get the stuff out of my eyes. I had fallen face first into a tank of junk, you know, and Curly fell on top of me, but I forgot to close my eyes when I went in, see. Which happened many times.
Did he laugh at your shorts, do you know? Was he personally amused by the Three Stooges?
Harry Cohn?
Yeah.
Do you know that he took every one of our shorts home to his projection room?
And ran.
Uh-huh. You know, there's a great story. You know, we were in my sister Eileen, by mistake. Well, not by mistake. It was by design, but it was very funny. We were on our way to lunch, and His name was Al Green, was directing my sister Eileen. And on the way back, we got back fairly late from lunch, and they were shooting. So we walked in on the stage. They weren't ready for us yet on our stage. And we watched them shoot, and it was where the fellas under the floor. Are you familiar with the story? They were blasting underneath the subway.
Putting the subway through,
yes.
Under their apartment.
Yes. And then this cement thing comes up, and the fella came up with a iron helmet on, the whole thing came up. And the director said, cut. And I knew Al Green pretty well, and I said, Al, this guy looks like a German soldier coming out of the ground. He says, yeah, I was just thinking of that. He looks awful. I said, why don't you let us go underground for a laugh? Hey, he says, that's a very good idea. He says, have you got another slab of cement? And they did. They had an extra slab, so they put it back. And we came out of the hole. And Curly says, hey, fellas, we made a wrong turn. See, so later on, when I was trying to get Harry Cohn to have us make a feature, he says, I don't know whether the market is ready for a feature with you fellas. You're doing great in the shorts. Why don't you leave it alone? I said, what do you mean? I said, we were good enough to be in My Sister Eileen. He says, you were in Sister Eileen? I says, we did a little tiny bit, he said. I said, what do you mean a little tiny bit? Who do you think was under the floor making all that noise all that time? I said, we were through there under there for the whole thing. Well, he broke up. He couldn't. Right after that, we made the picture there with Jimmy Durante and I forget who else. Oh, and with his then sweetheart. He married her later. Harry did. I forget.
Joan
Perry. Yes. So that was the only picture she ever made. He married her to keep her out of films.
Do you know how many features, how many shorts she made? Have you ever counted them? As a student.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. At MGM, we made... stop swinging his chair. It was whistling. Six features and five shorts at MGM in the 1 year that we were there. That was Turn Back the Clock with Spencer Tracy, Meet the Baron with Jimmy Durante and Jack Pearl, Dancing Lady with Joan Crawford and Clark Gable, Hollywood Party, which was an all-star picture with everybody in it, Fugitive Lovers with... what was that? Stars, I forget who it was. A bus picture. Can't remember the name now. Anyhow, we made six of them over there and five shorts. Then we made about, up to the last. I mean, the most recent feature, including those and the one at Fox called Snow White and the Three Stooges. And two independent ones, 4, 6, 7, 8. We made about 12 features at Columbia, and two independent ones, and 204 shorts, and 156 cartoons with live beginnings and live endings.
You're going over to the Philippines now. What's the name of the picture you're going to do over there?
Well, prior to that, I don't know. It's Philippine money to be deposited here, you know. But we just recently finished a one-hour comedy travelogue called Kook's Tour. Very cute.
Cute title.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. It's a funny picture. Now, we decided that there were many travelogues, and very interesting ones. But that's all they were. But coupling us and subtly showing the background in which we were working, you would show the people, the Grand Tetons of Idaho and Jackson Lake and all that, you see. So that subtly they were seeing a travelogue, but they were seeing, for instance, how not to launch a boat. The way we launched ours in that thing was murder. And how not to fish if you want to catch fish. In other words, Larry, who was never even got a bite, but every time he threw his pole over, that round ball that he threw, the float, that our dog would jump over, grab the float, and bring it back. He never got a chance. He finally got so disgusted toward the end of the film. He had one of those hats on, a round hat, and there must have been 40 lures, fish lures, caught into his hat, you know. Got so mad he threw his hat overboard, and by God, the hat caught 5 fish to finish. The show, all the geysers, you know, and the whole thing. And we did a gag where when the geysers are going up in the air, we brought a thing out of our little trailer, set it on the ground, a bunch of crazy wheels on it. We'd turn the handle like that, then you'd cut to the geyser, it would go up. Then we'd turn it back this way, and you'd cut to the geyser, it goes down, as though we were controlling it, you see. Until a ranger came along, and we beat it.
We have a younger audience for this program in New York, and I think it's the right one we're reaching, because I can't think of anybody who made comedies during the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, who are any better liked than the Three Stooges. You get a lot of mail from young people.
Oh, God. I'm trying to get out from under that stuff here. This is what's left out of about 300 that came last week.
You go to the WBAR in New York City.
That stuff there, outside of a bunch of Christmas cards, which I don't have to answer. So, I tell you, there's someone's misfortune is probably our good fortune, you know. After all, the competition is practically all gone. The great people, you know, Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Lloyd Hamilton, which was my greatest favorite, Larry Seaman. Then you have Laurel and Hardy, who were great. Their tempo entirely different from ours, but funny, you know. One expression on that face of Stan Laurel, boy, he could kill you with an expression. And it would take a burn that would take about 90 feet of film. See, where ours, we would get 9 giggles in the space of time. In the same space of time, it would take Laurel and Hardy to get 1 big laugh. See, our tempo was much faster.
It was a different pace.
Different pace. Of course, their Battle of the Century was one of the great things, you know. Of course, we had many Battles of the Century with pie throwing in ours. And we used the basis of all great farce. They call it slapstick. I call it farce. Of upsetting dignity. This was our formula. You see? Hit a man with a high hat and a spats and a cane with a pie, they love it. But don't try to do that to an old man, a little old woman, or a kid. Don't mess with them.
I see you wear your hair differently than I remember it.
Yes, yes. Of course, I diet and have dieted for years. And now I've let it go back towards its natural setup.
You've got a nice thick head of hair, though. Real.
What would I have done without it? And it's cut the way I use it. It's cut that way all the time. You see, cutting bangs.
Putting basin on it? Or?
No. No, they don't have to. Bob has been cutting my hair for about 30 years.
Have you been wearing your hair like that since the act began in the bangs? Did you always do that?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. Since I first came with Ted Healy.
Did the act change greatly as far as the style of comedy goes?
No, but you see, subtly, you would sneak into different material. We did it so often, a little at a time, that we never realized.
That there was a change taking place.
Like we did different types of material. We did the Maharaja, where Curly was the nearsighted knife thrower. I was his interpreter. And the other one was a pest that came from the audience, asking what the Raja would do. Oh, this was a great sketch. Then we did an operation. We played two doctors, and Larry was the patient. And then we did the stand-in, which we did in George White Scandals and on Broadway. And Milton Berle has been copying it ever since. That was a motion picture set. I played the director, Larry played the blonde-haired star, and Curly played the double. So... which was very successful. So I say we played many, many different sketches, like every week. Ed Sullivan we were on several times, Joey Bishop several times, who's the fellow with the glasses? In fact, he just asked for us.
Steve Allen.
Steve Allen, five times in New York, when he was in New York.
Did you have the same writers all the time, or most of the routines something you worked out among you?
No, we had bull sessions, you know, ourselves and the director. Then after we put some stuff on paper, what we thought, and we'd figure out what's a good background. Like, for instance, where don't we belong? Well, we don't belong in society. Well, let's make a society picture. Now, in order to make a society picture, we open the film as rubbish collectors, so far removed from society so that anything we did wrong in society was forgiven because they don't know any better. You know, what strata of life did they come from? What would they know about it? So at the end of the picture, the closest association with us, with society, wound up that the society was beating the devil out of each other, and we walked out, and I'll never forget my speech, when I said at the finish, the vicissitudes of one's circumstances and these surroundings makes it nigh impossible to state one's feelings. We walked out the door. My wife wrote that story.
Was she in show business?
No. No. No, she's only in show business by way of her cousin, is Houdini, the magician. Was Houdini.
Oh, really? Yeah. Have you children? Do you have children?
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure. I've got a daughter, whose husband has been our producer, director, and personal manager for the last 10 years. And I have a son who lives in New Canaan, Connecticut. He has a little girl. My daughter has a son past 21. The one fortunate thing is that along with the humorous dialogue, we have a lot of sight stuff that's funny. Like, we get letters from the deaf, who in most cases say, thank God you act out your jokes. See? Mm-hmm. And then we get fan mail from the blind in Braille, which Braille Institute translates for us, and we carry Braille autographs with Mo on it, Larry on it, and Curly Joe on it. So that we come across...
How would the blind appreciate you?
They do with some sense. I don't know how. Maybe they enjoy the dialogue and they can picture what we look like. They create their own image of what... Sure, that's... So, we get it from all directions, and it's very gratifying.
You sure were funny in my neighborhood when I grew up. I can't think of anything in Detroit.
Midwest.
I can't think of anything that brought the house down more than when the Columbia lady came on. They said Three Stooges. I've enjoyed this very much, Mo Howard. I want to thank you very much for letting me come to your house. It's a very pretty house, by the way. What area is this called?
This is called Beverly Highlands.
It's right above Sunset Strip.
Right above the Sunset Strip.
There's a few stars around here.
Yes, and the moon shines up here, too. Here I have Lerone and Martin live up here, and the whole works, you know. But that doesn't make an area particularly, to my mind.
No. It's a glamorous feature, I think people like to know.
Oh, we came up here because it was a view lot, you know. Get a nice view of the smog down below.
You got a good view of it today. It's very thick.
Is it really?
Yeah, I got up at 6 o'clock to do a TV show, and... It would have been a beautiful day if it hadn't been for that smog.
I haven't been out. Oh, yes, I have. I walk, I walk from here all the way down to Sunset Boulevard.
That's
even
nice
further.
Walk.
Even further. Nice every
walk.
Morning.
Do you walk up, though?
No. My wife picks me up.
The noise in the background is made by really a sweet, very affectionate little dog named Pogo.
Pogo, yes.
Pogo, wow.
You know, he's a sensational watchdog. Did you hear him bark when you came up the thing?
Yeah, but he'd let anyone in and play with him.
If he was outside, he'd bring him in.
Uh-huh.
See? But from inside, he'll warn us every time.
Very sweet little dog. Well, I've been talking with Mo Howard of the Three Stooges today in his home in Los Angeles, California, and I want to thank him very much. And by the way, you look very well.
I feel very well, and it's a pleasure to have you up here and to talk to you.
Thank you.
And I wish whatever your efforts are, that they might be a success. And along with it, I wish you a very, very healthful and delightful 1971.
Same to you, Mr. Howard.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed this very much. This is Richard Lamparski in Los Angeles, California. Thank you for listening. Good night.